Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and I'm in the Holiday Inn Regent's Park in London, the latest victim of the pod, as it were, though without the pod cat, Rosie Ledger, to intervene, is my friend and colleague in the past, and perhaps who knows the future, Kate Oakley, who is based here in London. Hi, Kate, how are you?
I'm fine, Toby, how are you?
I'm all right. I mean, it's very nice to be here. Fulham won yesterday, Leicester drew. We now have a miraculous 2 points from five games in the championship.
Well, they did acquire a broken leg along the way, is that right?
Yes, Bobby Zamora, Fulham striker in inverted commas. Well, he did actually score quite a lot of goals last year.
Yes.
But we're not here just to talk about that. We're here to talk about some of your work, because one of the reasons I wanted you to come into the pod is because you have been both a leading figure in and a major critic of creative industries as a policy push here in Britain and in Europe and really across the world. And so I was interested in finding out a bit about that, but I thought I'd start out by asking about what you've been doing just recently.
Okay. I'm currently teaching part-time at City University, which is in London, and also doing some work at the University of the Arts, also in London. And in my other non-teaching life in the other days, I'm doing some work on, I suppose, the latest iteration of place-based cultural regeneration, or whatever we call it nowadays, and also continuing to do some work on cultural labour markets, really.
Can you tell us about place-based cultural regeneration?
Well, I'm doing a piece of work for the Royal Opera House, Britain's most expensive for 60 years cultural institution.
More expensive than the Premier League.
Well, in public funding terms, way more. And they're doing a sort of building a new site, a production site, out in Essex, Thurrock in Essex. And I'm looking at their work in terms of developing, I suppose, a centre for craft skills in the performing arts. So I'm kind of interested in the way that, I suppose, having spent so much on consumption-led cultural developments over the last decade or so, there now seems to be something of a shift towards the production base, or at least in this instance, there's a shift towards the production base. So this is supposed to be a centre for, as I say, craft skills and performing arts. Whether the Opera House is a good institution to do that or not, discuss. But
craft-based meaning things like set design and carpentry, metallurgy.
Yeah,
and so
all
forth.
Of those things. Yeah, everything from armoury to lighting to... So it's a... I mean, there's...
Makeup.
Headers, the whole set. All of the backstage.
So girly things, gay things and blokey things.
Indeed. And performing arts, opera things like making armour to things that you might do in festivals and events.
Right.
So, you know, the bigger kind of live events sector.
You're hoping for an armoury-led recovery.
Absolutely. I think we can get those jobs up from 3 a year, apprenticeships in armoury, to 3.5. That'll be a major
change. Yeah. And also, I presume you're going to look at traineeships in spear carrying.
Exactly. And all that. Exactly.
So there are lots of stupid jokes like that you've had to put up with ever since you started working with the Royal Opera.
Indeed. Yes. Yeah.
And so what kinds of research or thinking, as it were, do you do in order to enable this place-based evaluation?
Well, I suppose why I'm interested in it is that it's significant as a shift in policy that's going on. So it's led by a large arts organisation. Questions about whether they're an appropriate organisation to do this or not. In that sense, it appeals to current conservative policy because it's big arts, both high art and big institution. At the same time, there seems to be a genuine acknowledgement on the part of that institution that it is, that it has to make a case for its own public funding, which you'll have to do in part in terms of wider benefits to the populace beyond just its status as a kind of arts organisation, but also its role in the kind of ecosystem of work. I suppose in the wider sector. So I think that's what I'm kind of interested in. I mean, what it involves is the usual going around talking. I mean, it's also quite interesting because it is in a very marginal area, both politically, sort of geographically. I mean, it's only about an hour out of London, but it feels incredibly far away. Traditional white working class area. You know, it's links with Covent Garden, which is where the Opera House Space in central London are very fragile, to be putting it strongly. Mm. So, I mean, that's kind of an interesting juxtaposition, I think, in some ways.
Mm. And are they using it also as a storage space? Where they keep sets?
Well, they are thinking of doing, not storage so much, they're thinking of doing, but putting a, whether there's any interest in this or not, God knows, what do they call it, a kind of archive there. You know, Margot Fontaine's tutu, sort of, you know, Rudolf Nureyev's tights, I don't know, all the stuff that the opera house has collected over 60-odd years.
That I keep in my loft will now suddenly be spirited away to White to Essex.
Exactly. Where I think there might be minimal interest, strangely enough, in either you or Rudolf Nureyev, but we shall see.
Surely not. Not after this podcast. So for them, hiring you to do this work is in part about being able to show, in instrumental sense, the value they are adding to regeneration.
Yeah, I mean, I think the people who've hired us, to be fair, are the education people within it. It's all, you know, these big organisations, there's never a kind of single face. There are groups within it. And the education people, I think, are genuinely interested in the potential for doing things in training, education, what you might call sort of community development in the broader sense.
Yes.
Whether that's the buy-in at that, of that, for other parts of the organisation may be very different, but that's what they're potentially interested in. So what they want to look at is a whole set of kind of measures or ways of capturing what's going on, in a sense, in that place.
And this ties into the cultural labour markets work that you're doing?
It does potentially more. I mean, this is a three-year gig, possibly, or certainly 18-month gig in the first place. The first set of stuff was mostly about place, but the second set, yeah, hopefully I will end up looking at what's going on in terms of cultural labour markets, because cultural labour markets have become, for the first time, I think, an object of public policy in the UK, or starting to become an object of public policy interventions, which they hadn't been, other than in terms of small business support for like 15 years or so. So there's been a lot of concern in academia about precarious labour, cultural labour markets, etc. On the other hand, there's been a kind of story about, the liberation potential of cultural labour markets. It's another kind of story. And public policy, it seems to me, has, for the most part, not really had a lot of role to play other than supporting small businesses and entrepreneurship. But it has, in recent years, provoked more by concerns about declining social mobility than anything to do with actual labour markets. And because of concerns about declining social mobility, it's actually started to take an interest in this field. So I think that in that sense, in the kind of policy sense, it's linked to the work on cultural labour markets.
Mm-hmm. Well, could you then take us back a little in time to explain how we got to where we are? And I wonder if one can remember back to the pre-New Labour days, to the period before 1997, when the Labour Party comes into power. Where did this creative industries idea come from? How did it displace cultural policy? Because I notice you're using culture rather than creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And what part were you playing in all of this? What was your experience of that?
I think it came from two sort of sources. One a bit further back, and one a bit closer to the 1997 level. So further back, if you look at the Labour Party, who were out of power for 18 years, essentially completely in the wilderness, and thought they may never get back into power.
Mm.
One of the things that they thought they needed a new story about, I think, was work. I think there was a long-term concern in the labour movement about work, but they wanted to have a story about work that got them beyond the battles of capital and labour that they saw running into the sand somewhat in the 70s. So they needed a narrative about work. There was that kind of strain of sort of, you know, enthusiasm for kind of post-Fordist labour, as it were, the potential of that kind of thing for good work. And I think there were people in the Labour Party who became very influential in the New Labour who were very influenced by that. So it tied in with kind of sort of notions of autonomy in a given sense, but also changes in the workplace. And I think the Labour Party in opposition became convinced that if you could get work right in some ways, lots of things followed from that, that you could, at the top end, as it were, of the labour market, you could appeal to the aspirational workers who had lost to Thatcher. So you had the kind of blur, not exactly greed is good, but, you know, the kind of relaxed about the rich kind of line. You had all that kind of Creative Britain sort of stuff. So appealing to that kind of aspirational thing. So I think at the top end of the labour market, it did that for you. The bottom end of the labour market, there was an idea, I think, completely unexamined, but there was nonetheless an idea that the cultural industries, or creative industries as they became known, offered a potential for working class people, people of colour and women, because they were linked to working class culture in some ways. So there was an assumption that these labour markets offered the potential for work, fulfilling, meaningful kind of work for people who had been previously marginalised. So it became very kind of central to the new Labour reinvention as a Labour Party. They had this optimistic story about work, I think. So I think that's one thing. I think from the other side, as it were, from the other side of the Atlantic, comes a much more straightforward story about IP, the creative industries.
Intellectual property,
the creative industries as developing sectors, the sort of David Putnam stuff about, you know, if the US can back its film industry like this, why can't we back our music industry or our video games industry? And I think those two things came together in the kind of 1997 creative industries moment.
And where were you in all of this? What were you doing in life back then?
Well, I wasn't, I mean, I was not even a trainee spear carrier at this point, so I was kind of, you know, very marginal to these debates. But I was doing work on, I've been doing work on sort of labour markets. I got Toby's now taking a break to
good
go
to see you.
Greet a friend of his.
Okay, sure. Okay.
So I keep talking, I'm going to keep talking. Okay.
This cover is a I'm doing the podcast. Okay, sure, see you tomorrow.
Sorry about that interruption. Short interruption.
One of my best friends, Runa Otterson, whom I'm going to subject to the podcast at some point, just arrived in the hotel, so I had to say hello to with pleasure said hello to her. My apologies, Kate.
That's quite
so
right.
You were not a trainee spear
I was not even a trainee spear carrot. I had been doing work on labour markets for a while and on, developing regional economies and things like that. But I hadn't really done anything on cultural industries per se. So that I got into that essentially by kind of accident rather than anything else. It's a sort of through a piece of work I did at the Demos think tank with a guy called Charlie Leadbeater. And I got into that through having done something else with Charlie and someone suggesting that I might be interested in doing a piece of work on cultural entrepreneurs, as we call them, and changing cities in Britain. So that was how I got into the kind of cultural industry stuff, really.
And
so I wasn't aware, I think it's probably worth putting out, I wasn't really aware of those kind of, those two things that I've described, the new labour work story, the new labour creativity story. I think they came into the world almost kind of, they were sort of delivered with the new Labour government in 1997, and there weren't a lot of people who was expecting quite a big shift in, I suppose, what we call at the time, cultural policy. And I certainly wasn't part of any of that thinking that led up to that.
So were you more thinking along the lines of, say, the way in which the former Greater London Council in the 80s was trying to stimulate culture industries here in London in terms of part of that agenda, namely opportunities for women, for minorities, and also in terms of an agenda that would stimulate not just high art, but the popular culture sector and make it industrial. That was more what you were on about at Demos.
Absolutely, it was to some degree. And I think that fairly early on, there was a moment in the new Labour period where it looked as if they might, that's in a sense, with different terminology was the kind of things that they were going to follow. But they were never as interested. That cultural industries approach required interventions in markets, in distribution chains and ownership, that New Labour were never going to do. Right. I think that was the battle that was lost within the Labour Party quite early on, or early on in the New Labour period, sort of thing. I think there was a moment when there was the influence that all the talk about stakeholders and Will Hutton's book and the interest in ownership of worker ownership of firms and those kind of things. It looked for a moment like they might have a more interesting story.
Yeah, would be more about terms like employee participation or industrial democracy.
Yes, and that was lost, I think.
Stakeholder capital.
Yeah, exactly. It was known. Exactly.
This guy, Will Hutton, who many listeners may not have heard of, but who's been very important in British debates on economy and society for the last 20 years or so, and was also the editor of the Observer newspaper, was a Guardian columnist, and now I guess is actually advising the Tories in some way.
Bizarrely enough. On pay differentials, I think.
In any event, so you're doing this stuff for Demos, and I'm surprised, I've heard you talk about this a little before, I'm a little surprised that Demos wasn't in on the origination of these Labour Party strategies and that you weren't aware of them.
I was a very new to it in 98, so maybe that they were in on it more. Certainly Charlie Leppington was in on it. But I think that the creative industries move itself came from the task force that was established by Chris Smith, and therefore people like Putnam and Chris Smith themselves and his advisor John Newbegin are much more central figures development than Dallas was.
Chris Smith was the Labour culture minister.
Yes, the first culture minister under the government.
And David Putnam, of course, was famous, first of all, I guess, as the producer of Chariots of Fire.
Indeed.
But then he was
briefly around Columbia, was it?
He was put in charge of a studio, Columbia Pictures, in the US, and was moved on, but came back to be what is called a lovey. And a lovey in Britain is a variant of the great and the good.
Yeah.
It specifically means
arty.
Theatrical, sort of probably male, white, wealthy, and part of a Labour Party.
Yeah. Yeah, of liberal to left political inclinations, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
I don't think you know a right-wing lovey, really.
People who have their own personal drivers. So they are what are sometimes labelled champagne socialists.
Indeed.
So Sir Richard Attenborough, who of course is known only to his friends as Sir Richard, but to everybody else as Dickie or Lovey, has a chauffeur.
Does he?
Yes.
You may well
know. While remaining a socialist, unto death, as it were. In any event, so you start to become almost embroiled in this by accident, because you've come at it from...
From
culture industry's perspective.
Well, I've come at it more from a kind of regional development, interest in work, labour markets place, and the cultural stuff. I mean, I was interested in it, but not in any kind of professional sense. So, yeah, I came at it somewhat from the side, by accident, as it were. And then when the Creative Industries Task Force happened, the term was created, and Charlie and I's piece came out, I was kind of assumed to have been more, I think, influential or something in the notion of the creative industry. But the notion of the creative industry didn't originate in Demos or any other think tank, really. I think it had roots in people who were involved in Demos, certainly. But it didn't come out of a think tank in any sense. The work was slightly separate from that.
And tell us a little bit about the role of a think tank like Demos.
Mm-hmm.
What was it doing and what were you doing in it?
Well, I wasn't ever in it. I was an associate, so I worked on a couple of projects, two or three projects. And being an associate essentially meant you were part of the kind of... Well, it originally meant you were sort of part of the reserve army of labour, that if they ran out and they had too much work for paid staff, then people who were associates would get... And you were an associate in the sense that you went along to things and you didn't know. And Demos had been very... probably reached the height of its influence just prior to New Labour being elected, and then when shortly after New Labour was elected for the first few years, when its then head, Geoff Morgan, went to run the policy unit, went to work directly for the government. So it was very influential in those kind of early years, and probably less so as the New Labour period went on. And there were other think tanks, the Institute for Public Policy Research, which is probably more influential in terms of broadcasting policy, where a lot of the work was done on broadcasting policy. The Smith Institute, which is a very small organisation set up in the memory of John Smith, who had been previously Liberal Labour Party, had quite a lot of influence in terms of this creative industries agenda, particularly under a guy called Will Stevenson, who had at one time run the British Film Institute, and then was running the Smith Institute. So there were a lot of little organisations who played roles in this as well, really.
Yeah. And as an outsider, I think of Demos, which continues today and pumps out publications and so on, as quite neoliberal, really. But is that wrong? Was it more social democratic, or are these the incorrect terms?
In the same way that New Labour did, Stuart Hall's famously talked about New Labour's kind of Janus-faced kind of thing. I think the Demos also had that. It certainly had social democratic people who were associated with it. I mean, it had what you might call a kind of neoliberalism. And it also had the sort of... strain of neoliberalism that was particular to New Labour, by which I mean it had a very sociological approach to its politics rather than a political approach to its politics. So it tended to take its cue from what it believed were long-term changes in society rather than seeking in a more political way to actually influence those changes in society. So I think that was it treated neoliberalism less as a political project and more as a kind of sociological reality with which it had to deal. And I think that's the distinctive flavour of neoliberalism you get under New Labour, which is different from
Hence the influence of people like Lord Giddens.
Yes, exactly. Giddens is, I think, is absolutely crucial to this. That kind of that particular kind of empirical sociology, interest in long-term change, is a kind of Schumpeter kind of idea, and sort of long ways of change, the sort of getting beyond conflict kind of idea of sort
yeah.
of getting past that kind of
the third way.
Exactly that kind of thing. Yeah.
Yes, quite. So in other words, this is trying to do post-politics in the same way that the Tories are today, in the same way that Clinton did,
yeah.
that Bush claimed to do,
yes.
and that Obama
yes.
is like, seeking to do.
Indeed, and that, interestingly, something like Thatcher didn't do at all.
No.
That was absolutely a political project,
yes.
and the things that came after it were less political projects.
Yeah, gotcha. So you're finding yourself in and around the end of the 90s as somebody, by accident, associated with what has become a major tendency, not just in Britain, but really across the world, this turn to a certain extent away from cultural policy as if it were an end in itself, either, you know, la pour la, art for art's sake, or as something that reflects the world back to the world and allows for liberal auto-critique, by the notion of regional development, industrial development, personal development,
mm-hmm.
and the unlocking of the creative subject
mm-hmm.
within
mm-hmm.
that is creative industries. You'd never actually signed on for this, but your name becomes associated with it.
Well,
is that right?
Yes, to a degree. I mean, I think that there's an interesting distinction between the kind of ideology of that, what the take on that that you sort of described, which is clearly part of the story, and the developments that were actually kind of going on in terms of what public policy was funding or doing in any particular instance. And if you looked at something like, I mean, it seems all pretty boring, you know, the Creative London, which was a London-wide set of interventions in the labour market.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, in some ways, certainly in the early days of that, it was very much a kind of cultural industry sort of intervention, shorn of, as I said before, shorn of a genuine desire to intervene in distribution and ownership. I think those are the things that were lost, and obviously where the whole thing turns on that, because it makes it a very different kind of approach. But nonetheless, it had many of the same concerns about increasing voice in its cultural terms, about increasing employment amongst marginalised groups, about you know, those kind of things, social inclusion, as it had become called, it was called something else previously. So in terms of the actual interventions that went on, a lot of them were closer to a cultural industry paradigm than sometimes is assumed. And the change was significant, but not absolute,
mm-hmm.
between those two approaches.
And of course, apart from this political component, this is also, in some sense, a UN trend. It's a millennium trend.
Yeah, it is. It is later on. And I think one of the things, when we look back on it, and actually it is quite significant, is I think probably the dot-com bust in 2001 actually put paid to a lot of the optimism and potential for job creation, etc., that these things had seemed to have. If you consider the period sort of 96 to about 2001, there genuinely looked like there was quite a lot of potential, even for countries like Britain and even for places outside of the favoured southeast of Britain, to reinvent their economies to some degree, at least not entirely around these things, but with a large component of these things. That actually starts declining after about 2001, but it wasn't noticed politically that it was declining in the UK for quite a while. But I think there seemed like a greater potential for job creation, certainly, in the early part of the
period. This is the new economy.
Yeah,
so
when it seemed like it had actually slightly more potential to be real.
So in other words,
I mean, not ideologically, but in just practically, it seemed like...
The notion is there were going to be 55 million Liam and Noel Gallaghers.
Well, the notion was Britain will be a world leader in the video games industry and it may well employ more than about 50 people. You know what I mean? It may employ thousands of people, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I think there was an idea.
And there'll be lots of small businesses instead of every time someone has an idea, they're selling out to a...
Exactly.
A big venture capitalist.
Exactly. And there will be a British games publisher, which there isn't. And those kind of things, you know. And there'll be, as there's always been, a European film distributor, and all those kind of things. It seemed like there was a moment in which that might happen. And then clearly that didn't happen. And the dot-com boom actually took a lot of the growth out of that market anyway, I think. But, you know. So I think that it wasn't entirely fantasy in the early day. There seemed like a lot of more potential
something
for
there.
Job growth or something kind of there. And it takes a long time for people to realise that actually job growth wasn't anything like as fast as people thought, that it was fairly precarious, that the labour market conditions and labour markets that were being produced by this were the nature, were the way that they are, that actually, you know, women and ethnic minorities and working class people were excluded from these kind of work, and, you know, to a great extent. I think that wasn't apparent, as apparent, in the early days, and became more and more apparent over the period.
That in fact it was going to be a lot like live theatre and music, even though it was supposed to be completely different.
Yes.
I.e. reliance on people exploiting themselves by doing work they actually like for incredibly small amounts of money, because had they been paid the way industrial workers had traditionally been paid and with those kinds of securities, then the business would have become uneconomic.
Exactly, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And the social networks, and hence, you know, informal hiring practices, informal recruitment, all those things would also, which are also, you find in artistic labour markets, you would find in
labour markets.
And then also, of course, the collapse of unions and things in the areas that were unionised, like TV, would also add to that process. So, yeah, I mean, you know.
Right. And what's the collapse of unionism in areas like television, in part to do with earlier decisions to get away from the duopoly of the BBC and ITV and contract out more television drama, for example, to small businesses?
Probably. I mean, I think almost certainly in retrospect. At the time, however, the Channel 4 decision to insist that Channel 4, which was a new station in the 80s, UTV's free-to-air TV station, had to source most of its material from independents, actually did create for a while a plethora of independent television companies, and many of them were outside the M25, outside London, the South East. So, you know, it allowed new voices and regional voices for a while to come in. Then, of course, those indies, as they were called, became super indies, and with the consequence that there was a loss of regional voices and diversity, etc. But for a moment, as often with these things, there was a moment when there were more voices, and it was a more diverse labour market. But yes, you're right. Those small independent TV companies never had the same approach to kind of work organisation or labour relations or unionism that the traditional big employers have had.
Now, so, we've mentioned regional development a couple of times, and for those of you outside Britain, it may not be obvious, but as soon as I hear Kate's voice, I hear regionalism. Because although she lives in southeast London, which is deemed magically not to be a region, she comes from Liverpool, which is home of, you know, the slave trade and industrial proletarianism and seafaring and Irish migration and all kinds of other migration. And these are traditional working class, either stronghold or weakhold, depending on your perspective, but is also a place that historically has been associated with progressive politics. And in certain ways, anyway,
certain
you're shaking
ways.
Your head.
I'm shaking my head because it had Catholicism was also quite a big hold on the Liverpool working class, so it has had, it's not as strongly associated with progressive politics as somewhere like Sheffield or Manchester, you could argue, because it's always had a strong sectarianism in its politics.
Yeah.
But yes, but yeah, but other than that, yes.
But the Liverpool Council at different times has been run by people in US terms, unbelievably far left.
Yes, that's true. Yes, indeed.
I think it's necessary to point out.
It is, yes. So it has a history of quite volatile politics.
And you know, people in the shipping industry.
Yeah. Absolutely. But of course, it wasn't ever a manufacturing working class culture. It was a kind of mercantile culture. So actually, unions played less of a role than in Manchester.
Yes, and when I say industrial proletariat, I might be giving the impression that it was a place that made things.
But actually, it wasn't.
It's
flog sugar and things like that.
Yes, exactly. It's really an entrepot.
Yeah, it is.
And hence
its
importance in the slave trade historically. And also for Irish migration. But one of the things that, when I first met you about 8 years ago, you were doing, which does relate to regionalism and creative industries, is, and this is something I never allow you to forget, even though you keep telling me that I'm actually wrong when I claim it, is that you were doing a creative industries regeneration model for Hartlepool.
Yes.
Tell people who may not be familiar with Hartlepool the one thing for which it's famous.
Is this the monkey story?
Yeah, this is the monkey story.
I think you remember the monkey story better than I. But I think it's also an urban myth. I think if there's anyone from Hartlepool listening, they'll be ringing
deeply
in
shocked
to say that this is in fact not true.
Well, actually, we have a lot of A1, B1, and C1 listeners in class terms from Hartlepool who are at the core of the Cultural Studies podcast audience.
But well, we've just lost them now.
We've just lost them now. But in Britain, it's traditional when you meet someone from Hartlepool to say, who hung the monkey?
Yes.
Because the myth is that during the Napoleonic Wars, a French ship was washed up in Hartlepool. The only survivor was a monkey who was immediately garrotted, as it were, by the locals on the grounds that...
He was a French spy, I think, wasn't
French
it?
French spy. So, other than that, what Hartlepool is not considered perhaps number one on the tourism trail.
No.
So what were you... What was the idea that one could creatively industrialise, de-industrialised heartlands?
Yes, yes. I mean, I think for a while it appeared that... That, you know, in a world of diminishing options for cities and towns in Britain and other countries, still suffering from deindustrialisation. In a world of diminishing options, the cultural sectors seemed like a good bet. I mean, they clearly needed some kind of employment base in the future. There were certain things like, I suppose, I don't know, growth industry like biotechnology or pharmaceuticals, which were never going to happen because they didn't have the scale and. You know, they didn't have Cambridge or something on their doorstep. Whereas, as I said before, I think because of the, in a sense, the links between popular culture, the cultural industries, and working class culture, there was always the assumption that even if you couldn't do anything else, there would be people who would be singing, there would be people who would be making music, there would be people who would be writing films, there would be people who would be writing stories, etc., etc., etc. There's something about this kind of, you know, vernacular creativity or whatever, which in a sense offered a potential for employment. And again, I think, of course, the logic of sort of capital over the last 15 years in the UK has again revealed that to be a very optimistic hope, because where there has been job growth and where there has been employment growth in these sectors, it's been in London and the South East for the most part. So there are very few places that can actually do this. But it's understandable. It seemed like a kind of potential growth area, which you didn't have to have any particular scale or assets to pursue, where everybody had a shot of being able to do it in some ways. And why not Hartlepool? Why couldn't Hartlepool have a couple of games companies? I mean, there were games companies at the time springing up all over the place, even in places like that, Dundee. You know, so in a sense, sort of, why not? And also, what else? You know, what was the other option for people? I suppose.
And what could city government do to attract that kind of industry?
Well, I mean, what they tended to do were things like if they had any kind of college or university, obviously they intend to try and do things around retaining graduates, because one of the issues about the UK and lots of other economies, I suppose, is that there is a kind of internal brain drain. So even though the north of England, Scotland, traditionally produced lots of high-skilled labour, it tended to go elsewhere. So there was lots of kind of grants available, there was studio space and workspace available, there were small business loans, there was investment in physical infrastructure and advice to help retain people and create this kind of small business entrepreneurial kind of culture, I suppose.
Now, the way you're talking about this is, A, in past tense and conditionally, and B, somewhat sceptically. So two questions arise from that for me. Do you think this moment is over, it's done? And do you think it was a success or a failure, if so?
I think it's over for the short to medium term. The current government, I don't think, has that much interest in regional development in the same way, because the Labour Party traditionally is now, again, Party of the North and Midlands and Scotland, so it always pays more attention to this part of the country where it gets its base from. I don't think this government is remotely interested in that. I don't think this government actually is as persuaded by the creative industries argument as the previous lot were. So I don't think, I mean, most of the infrastructure that supported this, whether it was regional development agencies, skills bodies, training bodies, you know, all these kind of funds have been got rid of in the last 6 months, or will be got rid of in the November spending round. So a lot of this infrastructure is being taken away. So yes, I think it's over temporarily. In the long term, even this government's going to have some kind of growth strategy, because it's going to be making a lot of people unemployed in the public sector. You know, it's got 3 million people unemployed and riots. It's going to have some story about where future employment is going to come from. And, you know, I wouldn't bet against it returning to this as a potential growth area. Has it been successful? Clearly not in terms of the issues about the kind of labour market it produces. It doesn't employ, creative industries, cultural industries, whatever you call them, don't employ large numbers of working class or otherwise marginalised people, and where it does, it tends to be low paid, fairly precarious labour. Hasn't really redressed the regional imbalances that you get in the British economy, but then that's a big ask, and arguably, you know, it could never have done that. It has, I think, succeeded in Britain still does better. I mean, Britain still punches above its weight. It still does better than most other European countries in terms of the number of people who are employed in these sectors. So there's clearly something that works about it. We still do popular cultural forms reasonably well, reasonably successfully by, you know, size of our economy, head of population kind of things. So there's something about the understanding, you know, that Britain's gone further in collapsing the distinction between the arts, high arts, as it were, popular cultural forms, the media, design, the whole kind of related series of activities you might broadly term as cultural. I think it has gone further in understanding the links between those things and therefore creating some kind of small, precarious economy based on it. But it is small, it's precarious, it's not very geographically balanced.
And I guess one of the debates in this is that in the attempts to provide numbers that back up the importance organically for creative industries, the value of policy to stimulate them and the outcomes derived therefrom, there is some controversy on the grounds that the statistics have been given more heft by including things like communications and information technologies, financial transactions, and services such as the sale of insurance and legal knowledge and education.
Yeah. That's true. I mean, the inclusion of software as a category was always very problematic from the early days, and therefore, even in occupational statistics, you get lots and lots of people who most people would not regard as doing anything remotely to do with the cultural sectors, however broadly you define them. So the numbers have always been slightly exaggerated by that. Nonetheless, there are certain kinds of activities which, you know, you see periodic kind of growth. And we didn't have a video games industry, now we do have one. Design is a more important element of most manufacturing economies. So, I mean, there is, you know, it's not like there's nothing going on.
Yeah.
It's just that the numbers don't really tell you the story.
Sure, sure. And moving forward a little bit in your own biography, if we could, from that period, you're in one of these, you are now as you were then, on the fringes of academia in terms of having a good job and in employment, but maybe you didn't necessarily want that. Maybe you enjoyed consulting. In other words, are you one of the folks who's in the precariat and happy to be so, or no?
Not anymore, I think, partly because I've kind of done it. I feel as if I've done it, and it in itself is more precarious because there's less of that kind of work around. Having said that, I wouldn't have not done it. And I do understand that the psychological benefits and the pleasures to be derived from self-employment. So in these debates about the precariat, I feel that I am able to speak to that side of the debate. Yes. I do think there's something about the enormous amount. If you can make a living as a self-employed person, you have an enormous amount of autonomy, not over your work, because you never get that, but over your time, over your day-to-day activities. You don't have to go to another building that's owned by somebody else. You know, there are lots of kind of benefits to that kind of work, which if you can make it work, I really understand why people endeavour to do so.
Yeah. Now, you also were doing this having had a background in literary studies.
Yeah, English literature, yeah.
And
yeah.
You did an undergrad and an MA in those fields.
No, I did an undergrad and an MA in information technology.
I'm sorry, you know. I've forgotten that. MA in information technology.
No reason why you would remember.
Latterly, you decided to do a PhD.
I did.
And this is in the context of somebody who has published up the wazoo.
Yeah. Well, I suppose it was a kind of I don't know if it was kind of a legitimacy thing about it, I suppose. I suppose I thought if I was looking for a job, it would be useful. It was a kind of legitimacy, sense of achievement kind of thing about it. And I've had the publications, and in Britain and in some other countries, you can do them by publication. So I decided to do it by publication, and indeed did it by publication. And I found it, there was something about reflecting on my own work, particularly because I was reflecting on it at a particular historical period that we've been talking about now, that I found kind of interesting and satisfying. So, yeah.
And what's it called?
It's called Creative Industries and the Politics of New Labour.
Oh, so it is quite tuned into what we're
talking about. Yeah.
And are you thinking of publishing it as a tome, or is it all
Most of it's been published, so the question is whether how much you can do, whether it's just a question of publishing more papers for the bits that haven't been published, or whether you could do a sort of collected edition. I'm unpersuaded by that, but some people have suggested it.
I think that'd be wonderful, because a metacritical account is always valuable, and especially from somebody who's there, however accidentally, almost at the get-go. In fact, your work, from what you were saying, with Ledbetter, was invoked as an instance of something that you didn't even know you had signed up for.
Well, yes, I think that's
rather like me and Noel. It's the connection between you and Oasis that I've been looking for a decade. I now have it. Don't I?
Yes, indeed, I don't think I've never quite at the number 10 champagne quaffing party, sadly, but you know, next time around,
yeah.
When the Miller brothers are in there, you know.
Oh no, okay, this is the next thing. I know you have a particular bodily response to the Millerbands, who are these people, David and Ed Miliband, for people not familiar with Labour Party internecine politics, who are, amongst other candidates, including our very own Diane Abbott, as it were, standing for the leadership of the Labour Party, and they're famous to me, not because of themselves, but because of who their parents are, a very famous, genuinely progressive leftist activists. Their mum is supporting Diane Abbott, quite publicly, interestingly enough, in the contest, and their father was a key theorist in the debates about structuralism versus, you know, party politics, descriptions of the possibility of socialism in debates with Nikos Poulantzas and others, although a very significant critic of the Labour Party for its failure to commit to socialism and the improbability of parliamentary socialism. He was a very important figure, a long way to the left, as is his widow, of the boys. But I know that regardless of your political differences, you think they've got rather nice hairdos or something.
I think this is a chance remark some time ago about my mild fondness for David Miliband. Now I've been elevated out of all proportion, but no, I'm back again for the election, in case anyone's interested.
Ed Miliband?
Yes.
Yeah, because
I did one of those online polls where you feed in your votes and it says you support kind of thing.
And what's the reason for choosing Ed? Oh, the other candidates, by the way, are Andy Burnham.
Who I've got a bit of a soft spot for because Jamie Carragher, who plays for my football team, gave him some money. Yeah, his campaign.
£10,000.
£10,000. Yes. But that's not enough to make me vote.
The aforementioned Diane Abbott, the only woman, the only person of colour, and Ed Balls.
Ed Balls, who I think has come best out of the campaign.
Isn't he?
Yes.
I hated him.
Yes.
For what I read about him. He's been stunningly good.
Yes.
And so he's the only one who actually mounts a critique of these bastards.
Absolutely.
Bastards, I mean the Tories.
Yes. And if he won, it would be fine by me because I think he's probably be good at taking them on. But he won't, I don't think. I think it will be one of the Miller brothers, probably.
The Miller brothers. And why is... Because the other thing about these guys is that they represent, in David's case, son of Blair, and in Ed's case, son of Brown, in the sense that, rightly or wrongly, and they both try to distance themselves from this, they were policy wonk workers for those two guys when Blair was Prime Minister, in the case of David, and when Brown was Secretary of the Treasury, in the case of Ed. And so they're associated with that dispute, which characterised British politics much more than a left-right split or a Labour-Tory split for over a decade, because Brown was, in some sense, more committed to intervention in the economy, and Blair was, in some sense, more committed to neoliberal reform, in inverted commas, of public services.
Yes, yeah, that's true. Why are we still stuck with that battle, are you asking?
Why does it matter so much that it's their delegates, their proxies?
Well, I think, as you said, they probably distance themselves from being their delegates and their proxies. I think there were interesting political battles going on within the Labour Party, but they were never between Blair and Brown. I actually think politically you couldn't really put much of a cigarette paper between Blair and Brown. There's nothing very interesting about the political division between them. Brown was seen as more statist, I think.
Yeah.
Blair was seen as more, as you say, possibly more neoliberal. But Brown was a person who deregulated the financial services sector.
Yeah.
And indeed was very neoliberal in his management of the economy. So I don't actually think that characterisation is entirely fair. Although it's certainly the case that Brown was more traditional supporter of state delivery public services.
In the European sense. Normally, when a party goes into opposition, the assumption is that whoever takes on the leadership is really a sacrificial figure who will lose the next election and be done away with, but will win back a few seats, and that after that, the next person or the person after that will roll into power. In this case, because the liberal democrat so-called conservative coalition is deemed to be rocking, and therefore the Tory majority not to be a majority. The hope on the part of many of these candidates is that the next leader of the Labour Party will actually be the next Prime Minister.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think it's quite a close election. We're up for a round of very heavy public spending cuts, which will make people feel unhappy. We're up for a round of austerity and continuing recession. They might pull it off. It's possible they'll pull it off. If they get 5 years in government, they might get the worst of the pain of it for the first few years, and it's possible. They'll get a rising economy towards the end of the period, and people will be quote-unquote grateful. But nobody would bet against it. It certainly wasn't an incredibly comprehensive victory by the Conservatives, and the Liberal Democrats would probably get wiped out if it was an election tomorrow.
So. Well, I wonder this, because you think about the fact that The Guardian, our newspaper in good commas, actually editorialised in favour of a vote for the Liberal Democrats.
It did, yes.
Now, I'm not suggesting that newspaper endorsements matter in politics in the sense of influencing things, but they index something.
Yeah, they do. Well, they index exhaustion with New Labour and the tiredness, and of course, lots of people on the left had deserted New Labour after the Iraq War anyway, so they'd kind of lost a lot of voters, and they got some of them back this time, actually, because it was a genuine fear of a Conservative government. But yes, there was a hope that the Liberal Democrats would represent a kind of breakthrough in British politics away from the kind of two-party stalemate. And we're in some ways were seen as to being on the left of the Labour Party. But of course, unlike the Labour Party, they don't have any roots or any votes in working class areas, and they don't have any history with the trade unions, etc. So in a sense, they could be more liberal on civil liberties and lots of kind of issues than that, and were to the left of the Labour Party on certain other kinds of issues. But at the same time, they were always going to be more comfortable with public spending cuts and a kind of shrinking of the state than the Labour Party ever are going to be.
It's astonishing, too, when you see the British cabinet filmed. I mean, everybody looks like me. I mean, every single
They look even richer than you, Toby. They look like white men with a lot of money.
White men who never done a day's work of lives with a lot of money. And with the same hairpiece.
Yes, they're alarming. It's probably the most socially narrow cabinet we've had since Edwardian times, I would think. Well, I would suspect. It's just extraordinary.
It's incredible, isn't it?
Plutocracy, absolutely. It's
absolute
extraordinary.
Plutocracy.
British governments used to have teachers and coal miners and things like that.
Accents are all very similar.
Yes, they all went to the same schools. It's incredibly.
By the way, George Osborne, who's the treasurer, went
to Toby School.
Yes, it's just thanks, Kate. I thought I was going to drop that in, but you beat me to it. Yeah. And we're coming towards the end of our conversation, but I wanted to ask you about a couple of other things. One is what you see happening for you next, what your plans are, intellectually, politically, professionally.
I'm continuing, hopefully, to do work on labour markets. I'm interested in doing some work around the politics of cultural policy in particular, because I'm kind of tired of the way we treat public policy increasingly as a kind of not politically produced, i.e. in some ways even researchers are brought into the kind of managerialism of things, and we tend not to look at the politics of policy making, I think. And I think that's often been true of cultural policy, which is treated as if it wasn't public policy at all. So I'm kind of interested in doing some work on the politics of these things and also the political history of them, because I think, again, we tend to operate in a very ahistorical mode in a lot of these kind of debates. So that's what I'm interested in doing work-wise. I'm looking for a job.
And it's a job. And how are you defining politics when you refer to this revisionist account?
Well, it's not really a revisionist account, and it's not that I think it's completely lacking from other kind of accounts. It's just that you tend to often get cultural policy in particular analysed in rather discrete chunks of time and geography. as if they kind of arose separately from other wider. So there isn't really. I mean, of course, there are debates about the creative industries as a kind of moment of neoliberalism. But beyond seeing it as a moment of neoliberalism, there isn't a lot which takes you into the kind of neoliberalism that it represents, its origins in non-neoliberal politics as well as in kind of neoliberal politics, what that means in other kind of geographies and territories outside of its, you know, Commonwealth kind of birthplaces. Those kind of things, I think, we don't really talk about as much as we should. And there certainly isn't as much kind of empirical work, you know, research work in that area as there ought to be.
It's also one of these things often, isn't it, where there's a lot of advocacy.
Yeah.
Where a lot of people doing traditional, say, arts management or arts administration work are true believers you know, whatever it is, whether it's arts and crafts or orchestras or ballet. And a lot of the people who are talking about film policy think that one has to have a cinema in one's production wing. It's part of being a mature nation, one that can reflect itself to itself, but you must have live theatre.
There is. Which is another benefit you get, possibly a benefit, I don't know, from coming from, not from a non-arts consuming background, because obviously I'm from an arts consuming background, but not from that kind of advocacy world, I suppose. So I'm not interested in film policy. I mean, I'm interested in films, I'm interested in film policy, but I'm not interested in film policy because I'm interested in films, in the same way that I'm interested in sport, but I don't play any games. Do you know what I mean? So I think there is a difference that you bring to those kind of things, and you're not coming from the point of view of somebody who's in it because of passion.
Yeah.
In that sense.
Yeah, absolutely. That's fascinating. And that relates to my last question, which is about sport, in fact. Sport was sometimes in the amalgam of portfolios that included things like cultural and creative policy. Was it ever part of the metric of the creative industries?
It was at a regional level. There were various attempts to get sport into the kind of agencies that were doing various things, and obviously, but it's always founded in the fact that sport essentially roots its claims to public spending in different kind of arguments. I think so. It's kind of the only place where we've really come together with something like the Olympics, I suppose. In something like the Olympics, you have people involved in capital projects to support the development of sport as a kind of both. Not exactly industrially, it's more about kind of community participation and kind of things like that. So I suppose there are links there to the arts, but it's not really, because the sports industries, for the most part, or at least the very successful sports industries, aren't seen as claimants on the public purse in quite the same way, even though, of course, indeed they are claimants on the public purse. But it's characterised as being different motivations, different politics, different agencies, different things. So they're never really brought together. I mean, I think that's a problem, actually, personally. I mean, I think we ought to think of sport as a cultural industry, but I don't know anyone in a kind of, with any administrations who do treat it in that way, possibly Australia.
But it would be fair to say, wouldn't it, that there is, as in many of these arts areas, a tension between the idea of elite industries and how to develop them and support them and participation.
It's massive in sport. And in Britain, it's sort of been resolved by having, it was resolved by having an elite sports agency and a participation sports agency, and they're probably going to be merged because of cuts in public spending. But it's huge in sport. The difference between elite sports and sport for health, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Sport for community participation have always been
Good to be active
in some ways.
Yeah. Sort of moralistic notion of healthy mind, healthy body.
Exactly. And also joined nowadays by, of course, this new strain of work, research on well-being and that kind of idea, which of course also sport feeds into quite a lot, you know, how it's good for your well-being if you go out.
I was in Rio de Janeiro a couple of weeks ago at a conference on happiness. And the compulsion to be happy.
Yeah.
And the desire to measure happiness in ways that say, we was poor but we was happy.
Oh, right.
In other words, fear not that you live in a hovel and you're running water because you're happy.
Right.
In a shoebox.
Yes.
Our mother loved us.
Yes, yeah. There is a strain of that argument. The other one is slightly more, I think, not more alarmingly, but another kind of alarming thing is the UK government recently has done some research on well-being and sport and arts participation, and it's backed away from that now, but in the end days, we're seeking to kind of turn that into money. You know, going to the British Museum is worth 30 grand a year to you in terms of happiness, kind of argument. But they have backed away from them now because, you know.
Because Lord Sainsbury and his wife gave him £25 million today. And on that score, could I ask just to conclude the sport thing and conclude the podcast? Because we have to go off and do...
Be happy.
Be happy together.
Increase our well-being. Yeah.
With our friend Pete. Given what we're seeing at the moment in the world of football, association football, soccer, which is to say massive overreach financially.
Yeah.
Incredible gearing of loans. The notion of for-profit, corporate-oriented ownership and so on. And given what we're seeing in cricket at the moment, which is a massive scandal, not over match-fixing, it seems, but over spot-fixing, where certain deals are made, that certain events will happen, heavy bets are wagered, money is paid to players, allegedly, not to influence the outcome, at least it appears not, of a game, but instead to say, you know, in the 14th minute of the 14th day of the 14th month, the following thing will happen.
Yeah.
Do you see a role for the state intervening in these things, or do you think sport should be allowed to continue with what is its relative autonomy compared to lots of other practices from state intervention?
I would have liked, I think it's getting very late now, but the problem is now that I would prefer it for a country like the UK to have the Bundesliga kind of model of football ownership and to have had restrictions on foreign ownership, on players' wages, all these kind of things. But now you're intervening in something which is kind of falling apart under its own steam.
Yeah.
So you're buying into something that's incredibly overpriced, it seems to me, in that sense. It's difficult. I mean, even the very wealthy backers of Man United, the so-called Red Knights, whatever they're called, the City backers, couldn't actually, in the end, get enough money together to buy a club which is massively over-leveraged.
In the case of your team, Liverpool, which is owned by two US guys who can't speak to one another, who are National Football League owners with gigantic debts, who were using the presumed cash flow from Liverpool's success in Europe, in particular, to fund their own debts.
Yeah.
That's led to a situation where the attempt to build a new stadium, which is in order to make more money, failed because they couldn't raise money for that. The purchase of players was undermined, partly by the purchase of ludicrous people, but also by the requirement to use a lot of the cash flow to fund debts in other businesses. And this has led to the point where the Royal Bank of Scotland may be repossessing the team.
Uh-huh.
Now that gets interesting, doesn't it? I mean, how does a Liverpool fan make sense of that?
Well, I think you're just completely... I mean, the Liverpool fan, any football fan, is completely stunned that this is illegal in a sense. Essentially, it's like me buying this hotel that we're the chain that we're now sitting in on, with having no money to do so, and loading my own personal debts onto... I mean, it's, how it was ever allowed to happen is a kind of great sort of source of mystery to me. What would happen if they... I mean, if Liverpool go bust, it wouldn't be the first time football clubs have gone bust before, and what the Premiership docks some points from you, I believe, and you go down a division. That's essentially what happens when you go bust. I don't know what the Royal Bank of Scotland do with Fernando Torres.
But it's a fascinating moment of incredible overreach.
Yeah, it is. That's why I think it's difficult to intervene now, because it just seems to be a constant to be sustained at the moment.
So in a sense, what you're saying is, just as we shouldn't have saved the banks that are too big
to
fail.
Save football clubs now.
Yeah.
Let's wait till they've failed and we can get them at a knockdown price, is what I think.
Yeah, and then repossess them as fans only.
Exactly, because otherwise you are socialising the losses.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, privatising
as usual,
profits.
Socialism for the rich.
Yeah.
And capitalism for the poor. Yeah. Well, Kate Oakley, on that, as usual in our conversations, utterly optimistic note of how we're going to smash capitalism and make everybody wealthy and happy, especially happy, of course, because we know it's not nothing to do with wealth. Thank you very much for being in the podcast. It's been a joy to have you here.
Thank you very much.